Okay, we've got several classes going on this morning, which I hope you're aware of. There's a class down the hallway on worship, New Testament worship. There's a young adult class going on, and so you're welcome to go to any of those classes. You don't have to be in here, but I've asked the ushers to lock the doors here in about 30 seconds, so you won't be able to go anywhere. Just kidding, those doors don't lock. We're glad that you're here. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 this morning, and covering some very important verses here. And, you know, as we go through the book of 1 Corinthians, there's no way for us to really spend time diving into every single verse. I wish that we could. The last couple weeks, we've gone through chapters 8, 9, and 10. And have you ever gone to a potluck dinner and you feel like maybe there was a little bit more food left over than what you started with? Maybe you have Thanksgiving dinner, and you're putting the leftovers away, and it's like, how do we have this much left over? You know, where did all of the food come from? Well, that's how I feel like sometimes when we're going through a study of a Bible book is that we get to partake of and feast upon a little bit of what's there, but sometimes I feel like there's a lot left over. I'd like to give you some Tupperware and send you home with some Tupperware full of some remaining stuff that we don't get to talk about, but I don't think that's possible. So we've done that with chapters 8, 9, and 10. I feel like the last few weeks just we've covered a good part of it, but there's certain parts we just haven't been able to get to. But that's okay. You're getting that on your own study. We're trying to make sure that we emphasize those things that are of great importance as much as we can in these chapters. And so we come to chapter 11, and you know, as we've been walking through the book of 1 Corinthians, that, you know, each book of the New Testament is unique. Each book is written for a particular purpose. Each book has its own particular background that's going on. You know, you think about the book of Philippians. And the book of Philippians reads a lot differently than the book of 1 Corinthians. I'm not talking about one is longer than the other, that's obvious, but they just read differently. You read the book of Philippians, and it's a book that's just full of joy and rejoicing, and thank you for this, and let's rejoice in the Lord always, and I'm thankful, I pray for you all. And it's just full of, now, where was Paul when he's writing the book of Philippians? He's in prison. That's just, how are you so full of joy and conveying that when you're in prison? And so it is a very encouraging book to read. Book of 1 Corinthians is different. Not that they're both inspired by God. They're both written by the same human penman. And yet, why is this book different? Why doesn't he just write the same book to all of the churches and they all get the same message? There's different things going on in these congregations. Did they all get the same message? Did they all get the same truth?
Yes.
Well, yeah, and we've seen that in this book that we're studying, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 7, verse 17. Both say, what I preach in one place, I preach everywhere. So it's not that the church in Philippi got something different than the church in Corinth or vice versa. But it's interesting as you read through this book, it is a very... There are times where he's very sharply pointed at them and making corrections because they had gone down a path. We begin in the first part of this book when seeing that they were kind of full of themselves,
yes.
Kind of full of their own wisdom and their own ideas, and that had caused them to divide the church. And now they're dealing with division inside the Lord's church, and he says that's not right. The plea of God is that you all speak the same thing, and that there be, how many divisions would be okay with God? 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10, how many divisions are okay? No divisions among you, not two or three or four or a thousand, none. That's the desire of God. And so he dealt with some things that had been reported to him in those first six chapters. And then you get to these last 10 chapters, starting in chapter 10, and he starts answering questions that they've had. Now, we've noted as we've gone through this, as he was dealing with issues that the church had, as he's dealing with questions that they have sent to him, what's the overriding answer? What's the theme of this book in regards to all of these things? Jesus Christ is Lord. When the church is dealing with some issues, what do they need to remember? Jesus Christ is Lord. When the church has some questions, what about this? What about this? What about this? We think this. What do you think? What do they need to remember? Jesus Christ is Lord. Not Paul, not them, not some other person. And so that's the theme, when especially, and this is emphasized in those first several verses of chapter 1, and then it's just carried through the rest of the book, that if you want to deal with division in the church, you got to remember that Christ is Lord. If you want, and we looked in chapter 7 at this first question they asked about marriage. What do they need to remember when it comes to the question of marriage and divorce? Well, Christ is Lord, not any of us. When we looked in chapters 8, 9, and 10, as they were asking questions about, you know, eating meats offered to idols and all of that, what do they need to remember? Christ is Lord. And so now we get to chapter 11 today, and they're dealing with some questions. Perhaps they asked some questions that Paul is addressing regarding worship and regarding their assemblies in the church. And so that theme resides here, that Christ is Lord. And so we begin in verse 2 today. In my opinion, I would have, if I were dividing the chapters and the verses, and it's probably a good thing that I wasn't the one that was allowed to do that, but if I was dividing the chapters and verses, I would have left chapter 11 and verse 1 back up with chapter 10. Now, that may bother you, but remember that chapters and verses are not in the divisions of chapters and verses. That's not inspired. Paul was not writing in chapters and verses. He didn't come to chapter 11 and just write at the top of the page, chapter 11. That wasn't there. In fact, chapters and verses, that wasn't divided until about 1,200 years later. Can you imagine being a Christian in the first 1,000 years of history of the church and there weren't chapters and verses in your Bible? How long would Bible class be then? You know, flip over to this verse. Well, hang on a second. Where is that? And so how blessed are we that we can say, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2, and you get out your phone and you just tap, 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 and you're there. I think chapter 11 verse 1 kind of fits with the context of chapter 10. But anyway, you come to chapter 11 and verse 2, and he changes subjects, but maybe he doesn't change subjects. He's been dealing with chapters 8, 9, and 10. He's been dealing with this matter of liberty. You know, is it okay for me to eat meat offered to idols? Is it not okay? He's been dealing with the relationship of Christians to idolatry. Obviously, they don't worship idols anymore, but, you know, Corinth was a city full of idolatry. It's full of the church is full of Christians that had come out of idolatry. Okay, how do we relate to that now? Well, maybe that's still being carried into chapter 11, because as we're going to deal with this matter of the head covering for women, this was something that was still a part of their lives because of the paganism and the idolatry that was there even inside the city of Corinth. But let's start in verse 2 where Paul says, "Now I praise you, brethren." Hold that thought. Go over to verse 17. What does he say in verse 17? "But in giving these instructions," what? "I do not praise you." So I want you to see the difference. From verse 2 to verse 16, Paul says, "I praise you in what you're doing because you're following what I taught you, the traditions," verse 2 as he calls it. But then you get to verse 17 and he says, "You're not doing what I taught you." And so there's kind of a separation there, but I think, again, he's dealing with some questions they've asked. "Now I praise," back to verse 2. "I praise you that you remember me in all things and you keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you." Are traditions a good thing? Careful how you answer this question. It's a trick question. I'm going to tell you right now, it's a trick question. Are traditions a good thing or a bad thing? You all are not answering in unison here. Can traditions be a bad thing?
Yes.
Did Jesus ever condemn traditions? He did. He condemned the traditions of men in Matthew chapter 15. Traditions that men had invented, created, and used to follow rather than following the law of God. What about things that would be the traditions of, not men, traditions of God? Is that different? Well, that's different. Why? Because what does tradition mean? Here's something that's been passed down. Here's something that's been handed down. And if it's handed down from man to man to man, well, you know, what did they put in there? But if it's a tradition that's been given to us by God, that's all that Paul's dealing with here. When you get over to 2 Thessalonians, he's going to use that same concept, chapter 2, verse 15, chapter 3, verse 6. Going to deal with talking about traditions of God. He's not talking about something that man has created. He's talking about here's something that God has taught us and has been passed down to us by God. And so verse 3, he lays out God's divine order of authority when he says, I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Some people read that and think Paul was a chauvinist. What's his problem? What's he laying out here? Is he laying out a tradition of man? No. He's laying out the divine authority, the divine tradition that's been a part of God's plan from the very beginning. So he says in verse 4, every man, is there a difference between how he starts verse 4 and how he starts verse 5? Verse 4 begins, every man. Verse 5 begins, but every woman. Is there a difference between a man and a woman?
Yes.
Is that a difference that can be understood, observed? Here, these verses, verse 2 through verse 16, there's maybe some confusion, and we're going to talk about that as we go through this. But here's one of the principal lessons we need to learn from these 15 verses down through verse 16. God sets up a difference between men and women. God distinguishes between a man and a woman. He always has. And what he's dealing with here is showing a distinction, verse 4, and a distinction, verse 5, between that which is what was general for a man in that custom and what's general for a woman. Well, did they ever have to define what's a woman? Were they ever asked to define what's a woman? Do you think they understood what a woman was? That's not hard to figure out. This church didn't say, but Paul, you know, what if I identify as this? No, it was understood. It was clear as could be. It's only recently that man and man's traditions have tried to alter that. But this, and that's one of the principal things I want you to get from these verses, is that there are distinct roles, there are distinct responsibilities, there is just distinction in general between men and women. So what does verse 4 say? Every man praying or prophesying, that's the context here, in a context of praying and prophesying, if he has his head covered, he dishonors his head. But, verse 4, every woman who prays or prophesies, same thing, that's the context here. Every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. You got the distinction? If a man prays or prophesies and he's got his head covered, well, that's a dishonor. If a woman prays or prophesies, she's got her head uncovered. Well, that's a dishonor. Well, why? The end of verse 5. For that is one, if her head is not covered, that is one and the same as if her head was shaved. All right. What is this talking about? Have you ever wondered about these verses? Have you ever had somebody ask you a question about these verses in regard to, do women need to wear a head covering today? Do women need to wear, maybe you've got a verse here or a title of this section here about what has the word veil in it. Do women today need to wear a veil? Do they need to wear a head covering? And there are some who have taught very adamantly that needed to be done. Well, let me ask you this question based upon verse 5. Today, is it the same thing today that if a woman goes around and she doesn't have a veil, is that the same thing as if her head were shaved? Just in our land today, in our culture. If you see a woman who does, I see a lot of women who don't have head coverings on today. Is that the same as if your head looks like David? Is that the same as if your head is shaved? It's not the same, is it? And so why is he dealing with this? Is he applying a principle? Is he applying not just principle, is he applying a commandment that's got to be carried through for the rest of time? Or is he dealing with something else? Look in verse 6. We're going to allow the verses to kind of explain this to us, but what do we see in verse 5? A woman uncovered is the same as if her head were shaved. That doesn't fit in today's world. Well, look in verse 4. He goes on to explain, for if a woman is not covered, if her head is not covered, if that's the case, let her also be shorn. But, are you all with me in verse 6? Do you have the word but there in the middle of the verse? You got first sentence, a period, and then maybe you have the word but. What's the word you have after the word but in the middle of the verse? Do you have the word if? That's an important word here. Because the word if says, if this condition exists, then this. Well, what does it say? But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. Is it shameful? Is it disgraceful in all cultures for a woman to be shorn or shaved? Notice how he's placing this within a condition statement that says, if this is the case, then let her be covered. What's going on in this culture? You go back into that first century culture, you go back especially into the city of Corinth. City of Corinth, we talked about at the beginning of this class, has the temple of Aphrodite in it. Has this temple to the Greek goddess Aphrodite. And we talked about how that temple had all of these priestesses, slash i.e. also known as prostitutes, who worked at that particular temple. Do you think they dressed differently, those priestesses slash prostitutes? Do you think they dressed in a certain way? And would it be appropriate for a Christian woman to dress in a certain way that might make her look like somebody else? Might make her look like she is someone else. And so in this culture that he's dressing, first of all, he's talking about a woman being covered. Sometimes people in modern day, in the last century, various Christians who have thought that a woman should have her head covered would be okay if the woman just had a kind of a hat on. That if she just had a pretty hat, you know, with a little flower on the side, then she's got her head covered. That's not the word here. That's not the context here. Not talking about just making sure that the top of your head is covered. The word that is used for, as we're reading through here, except when we get down to the verse 15, as we're reading through here on this idea of being covered or uncovered, the Greek word that is used here is a word that, it was a compound word that meant cover, and then it had a prefix on it, down. It meant to cover down all the way. And at the very least, it covered her entire head all the way down to the shoulders. Some of them would have had a covering from the top of their head all the way down to their feet. At the very least, it covered the entirety of her head. Is that the same thing as having a hat on your head with a pretty little flower or something? This covering was not just a veil like a bride. You might see the word veil and you might think, oh, that's what a bride wears. Mm-mm. That's not what's being discussed here. This is a covering that would cover down, literal term here, all the way down to at least her shoulders. And the only thing you could see would be her eyes. So if we're going to bring this over and say, well, that's what women need to wear today, I shouldn't be seeing any of your ladies' hairs, your ears, your lips, your noses. The only thing I should be able to see is your eyes. Well, is that the direction that some folks want to go? No. So what's happening in this text? In this text, Paul is dealing with a situation in Corinth that these Christian women were having to encounter. And so what he's doing is he's taking a situation and regulating for them. He's taking a scenario where some women wear a covering and some women do not, and he's regulating this to make sure that the women in the church are not confused for those who are not Christians. Because it was common in that day for women to go around and to let the men know that they were available by not wearing a veil. not wearing a covering. And if one was condemned, and in Corinth, this maybe not was done very often, but if a woman was condemned for prostitution, her head would be shaved as a sign that this is the kind of woman this is. And so if you're a Christian woman in that society, you want to go around with your head shaved? What would they indicate? You're guilty of prostitution. If you went around in that culture, in that city of Corinth, and you did not have a covering on, you go and you're in an assembly where there's praying and prophesying going on, and you don't have a head covering on, and that's an indication that of not being in subjection to your husband, of not being one who, and making yourself available, is that what a Christian woman wants to demonstrate? No. And so Paul is dealing with this culture, trying to make sure that there is a distinction between a Christian and a non-Christian. Back this up. Shouldn't there be a distinction between a Christian and a non-Christian in all aspects of our life?
Yes.
When Romans 12 says, be not conformed to this world, should the way I dress in general look differently than perhaps some who are not Christians who don't care about the way that they dress? Are there certain ways that you can dress today that, well, might say that I'm available? Well, yeah, there's certain ways you can dress. Is that the way that a Christian woman needs to dress? And so there are principles here that we can take and apply. Think about this also. When Paul talked about greet one another with a holy kiss, did you all do that this morning? I watched some of you come in this morning. I didn't get a single kiss. Bunch of sinners. I didn't get a single kiss. Why didn't you greet me? Richard, thank you. Freddie, thank you for not greeting me with a holy kiss. All right. So, but what's the deal with the holy kiss? That was a common greeting. The kiss, and by the way, you know it wasn't on the lips, and you know it was just, you know, the side-to-side peck kind of thing, but on the cheek. But that was a common greeting. So why is Paul telling them greet one another with a, does he say greet one another with a kiss? What word does he put before kiss? What is he doing? He's taking a common thing that's going on in that day and says, don't mess it up. Don't do it wrong. If you're going to engage in this, make sure you keep it holy. So what's he doing? He's not saying to 21st century Christians, you just sinned because you didn't greet David with a holy kiss. He's saying, if that's what's going on, if that's a common greeting, then you need to make sure that you're doing it properly as a Christian. Similar thing here. He's dealing with a cultural thing, and he's saying you need to understand the culture in which you are and to make sure that you don't present yourself in a way that would not be fitting for a Christian. All right, so let's pick up where we are here. So in verse 4, he says every man, and then in verse 5, but every woman. Verse 6, he explains it. That if it is shameful for a woman, then let her be covered. He's showing with the word if that this is cultural. By the way, go down to verse 13. What's the first part of verse 13 say?
Judge
among yourselves. What does that sound like? Does that sound like I'm giving you a command, now go and do it? What does judge among yourselves sound like? Use some common sense here. Pay attention to what's going on around you. And you make the best decision for what's going on around you. What? If a woman is supposed to wear a veil, you don't say, judge among yourselves. You just say, do it. You don't say, judge among. So, again, this is saying, look around you and see what's happening. Verse 7. Why is it that a man, why is it he's drawing a difference between a man and a woman? For a man, indeed, ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and the glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. Notice how he's making a distinction between men and women, but also drawing them together. Verse 8, for man is not from woman, but woman from man. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. Is there a difference between men and women? Yes. Are women to be in subjection to the men? That's what he started with in verse 3. That's what he's getting down here into verses 8 and 9. And so the not wearing of the veil, being uncovered, not having a full head covering, was an indication of not being in subjection. And he says here, that's not the role that God has for men and women. Verse 10, for this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. Again, the veil in that day was a sign of subjection. If she doesn't have it, she's saying, I'm not in subjection. And so Paul says that she ought to have the symbol of authority on her head because of the angels, the end of verse 10. Somebody says, what does that mean? I don't know. What does it mean, because of the angels? Why does she have to have a covering on her head as a symbol of authority because of the angels? Well, the Bible says that angels observe all of our doings. Are angels aware of whether she's wearing a head covering or not? Yeah. Are angels aware of God's creative order with men and women? Yes. Whatever the meaning is, God says that the angels are aware of this and that the woman in that culture should have this sign of authority on her head, that she should be in submission. Verse 11, nevertheless, neither is man. Now, don't think, man, don't get the big head. Don't think that you're all that. Neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. For as a woman came from man, even so man also came through woman. But all things are from God. Is there some interdependence that is there? Yes. So is God saying that one sex is superior to the other? No. Is he saying one's better, one's greater? No. It's different roles. And we're going to talk about this when we go over chapter 14. But it's just different roles that God has given. Not that he likes one more than another. Not that he's giving one superior and one is inferior or anything like that. It's just different. Now, let me ask you this question. Are men and women different? Are you married? Have you figured it out? Men and women are different. All right? Who made us different? All things are from, verse 12, God. God made us this way. So the God who made us different. And so the God who made us and he made us different, does he have a right to give us different roles and responsibilities? Yep. That's the one who designed us to do that. So he says in verse 13, judge among yourselves. Look out and see what is happening in this culture. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? In that culture, he's asking that question. Is this right or not? And then he goes on in verse 14, does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? Some people have jumped on this. But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. What's his point? In verses 14 and 15, is his point here to say that a man should never have long hair? Well, was there a thing called a Nazirite vow that some took in the Old Testament? And what was part of the Nazirite vow? Man was not to shave, not to cut his hair. What's his point here? His point in these verses saying, look, there's a difference between a man and a woman, and you can tell it when you look at them. Their hair is not the same. Have you noticed that David and Tracy have different hairstyles? Yeah. All right. Do you notice as you look around that most of the time, you can almost tell somebody's gender by looking at their head? That's the difference between a man and a woman. That's the way God made us. So he says, is it not by nature that generally a man's going to have long hair? And generally, what is it wrong? To ask the question, is it wrong for a man to have long hair? You have to ask the question, is it wrong for a woman to have short hair? Guys, you want to tell women it's wrong for women to have short hair? What's the point here? The point here is that God has laid out principles and there are differences between men and women. That's the why that it was wrong in that culture for a man to have his head covered when he was praying or prophesying, but for a woman not to have her head covered when she was praying or prophesying. Why? Because there's a difference between a man and a woman. And they ought to act differently. They ought to look differently. They ought to dress differently. That's the point. That applies to any culture. Now, do women have to wear a head covering today? No, that is not the culture in which we live. But if a woman were to travel to a culture in which women wear head coverings, and if they don't, it's a sign of not being in subjection. It's a sign of being loose and free, and I'm available. Should a Christian woman wear a head covering in that culture? Yes. Why? Because a Christian is to be different. Christians to look different. Real quick, the word covering at the end of verse 15, talking about her hair, totally different word. Not the same word that's used throughout the rest of the chapter. So some have said, well, isn't her hair her covering? That's not the point that he's making here. He's using a completely different word in that section. So verse 16, he says, but if anyone seems contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. This is the custom that's being practiced in that day among the churches, that this is the practice that we have, and we're not going to violate that practice, but you can take that and you can apply it throughout time, that we are not going to do that which violates the will of God. There are principles here that he lays out that we need to follow, this distinction between men and women, and making sure that we appear as being set apart from the culture in which we are living. I know that's maybe going through that quickly. Anybody have any questions, comments about those? John? Well, he lays out the principle in verse 3. He lays out the principle in verse 3, and that is a divine principle that hasn't changed from the very beginning. That just has not changed. Tracy?
It makes sense why they would have
this culture. Well, we need to understand their culture and understand where these Christians are coming from. There's just they've got a lot to unpack as they come out of a pagan culture and in a pagan religion and into the Christianity. Gary? Would it be wrong if a woman wants to cover her head today? What do you think? No. Why would she be doing it? Would she be doing it, you know, from the standpoint of condemning others because they're not doing it, or if she feels that it's something that she needs to do for her own conscience? And that's the previous three chapters talked a lot about doing things for the sake of your own conscience. Not wrong if a woman wants to have her head covered. I wish some women would cover more than just their head at times, but that's another subject. But wouldn't be wrong, Dan, and then Yolanda. Yeah, it does. The fact that he is making a clear distinction between men and women in this verse, in these verses, and the fact that that's been the case from that verse 3 is not a new concept. Verse 3 is eternal from the very beginning. There's been a distinction between man and woman. And that don't be ashamed because you're a Christian and you believe what the Bible says and that there's clear distinctions. You know, when our culture wants to change that and blur some lines or change those lines, those lines don't blur and they don't change. They never have. Yolanda? It's a good question. The question is, when we're talking about culture, is that the same thing as talking about the traditions of men? In some cases, I would say that they would parallel. I guess it depends on how we're defining and how we're explaining certain things. You know, there are certain things that fit a certain culture that don't fit in other places. You know, are things, some of you have done some traveling, you know, do people dress differently, behave differently, talk differently in various cultures in places around the world? Well, they certainly do. Is that the traditions of men? Probably so. It's things that have just been passed down. You know, some of them are not always religious. This was something that was that fit a religious situation that they were going through. By the way, when it's talking about a woman praying or prophesying in this text, was she praying and prophesying inside of the assembly while the men were present? That's sometimes some people come to that. Oh, the women were praying and prophesying, so it must be okay to have women preachers. They love this verse because they think it justifies women preachers. Is that what Paul's doing here? If he's doing that, he forgot that when he got over to chapter 14. And he just contradicts himself when he gets over to chapter 14. This has nothing to do with justifying women preachers or women praying or prophesying inside of a mixed assembly. Was it likely that there were women who were praying or prophesying inside of assemblies with other women? Would that be involved in that situation? I mean, how else? You can't have this chapter talking about it's okay for women to speak in the assembly, and then you go to chapter 14, verse 35, and he says it's shameful for women to speak in the assembly. Obviously not talking about the same general mixed assembly. Dirk, and then Richard. Well, verse 14, when he says, does not nature itself teach you? So, how now, he's not talking about, you know, the birds and the trees and the grass and that kind of nature. That's not where we're learning these things. That's not what's doing the teaching. But it's talking about, does not the way that mankind has existed on this earth, does not that teach you something that just seeing how mankind has lived on this earth, does that not teach you? Is there not a common sense of a common denominator, a common sense of right and wrong, that this has been typically the case and this has been typically the case, talking about the hair length? That's what's going on there. But his point there is to bring that, and again to emphasize his point in bringing that up is saying there has been a distinction, an observable distinction between men and women, just observable through mankind. Doesn't nature teach you this? Haven't you grown up understanding there's a difference between a man and a woman, and they look different? And that's why he's dealing with verse 4 and 5, the difference between what a man wears and what a woman wears when they go to the assembly where there's praying and prophesying. Richard? Right. Yes. And that's absolutely correct. And the point that Richard's making is that in this context, you're dealing with the assembly, you're dealing with the worship assembly, and we're going to carry that on through the next several chapters. And Paul is trying to address certain things that are happening in the assembly to make sure that when you get to the end, the very last, if you put this chapter in with chapters 12, 13, and 14, when you get to the very last verse of chapter 14 before he gets to the resurrection chapter, he says, let all things be done, what? Decently and in order. He's dealing with that here, that Is a woman in her appearance and whether she's veiled or unveiled, a head covering or not a head covering, and how that appears, is that being done, is that decently and in order? Could a woman come into the assembly and cause disorder, disruption by the way that she is dressed? Does that fit even today? Ladies, it still does. It still fits even today. And so, yes, absolutely. He's dealing with these questions as they come up. Let me, as Richard was talking and saying that, let me address this, and we're going to have to get to the rest of chapter 11 next week. I was hoping to get through the whole chapter, but you know me, we can't get there. Here's the deal. Here's what some people will want to do. They will want to say, okay, well, if the head covering over here is cultural, then fill in the blank, this is also cultural. If the head covering is cultural, then the Lord's Supper was cultural. How do you deal with that? If this was cultural, if the head covering was culture, then, fill in the blank, then a woman being in submission and not speaking in the assembly was cultural. So how do you deal with that? So what some have done, and I've only got 2 minutes on this, what some have done with the first 16 verses of this is because they have a hard time answering that question that we just asked, they want to say, okay, well, a woman needs to wear a head covering. Because it's right here in this chapter, woman needs to wear a head covering, we solve the problem, she wears a head covering, and then we don't say it's a cultural issue, and we answer. But it is a cult. It was something they were dealing with, and it was addressing a certain situation that women who were not veiled, that doesn't exist today. Woman not having a head covering in America, that doesn't exist. So we don't have to say that's not a cultural thing, but how do you answer that question? If that's cultural, then the whole thing about a woman not teaching or exercising authority over man, that must be cultural too. Or right here, the Lord's Supper in the assembly, that was just a cultural thing too. How do you answer it? Here's the short answer. We have 40 seconds. All of those other things, first of all, they have an underlying command to them throughout the New Testament. The Lord's Supper. It's the Lord's Supper, and I'm picking on the Lord's Supper because it's right here. Is the Lord's Supper just a cultural thing the church did back then and we don't need to do it today? No. There was an underlying command from the very get-go, from the institution of the Lord's Supper all the way through everything we read that says, no, this wasn't just something they did culturally. It was something that was to be an institution of the church every first day of the week until its end. All right? What about the role of women in general? That's where they go with this. What about the role of women in general? Well, that was a cultural thing. That fit the culture. But our culture, women have greater roles and responsibilities and authority today than they did back then, so it doesn't fit our culture. Well, how do you deal with that? You look for the underlying command, or you look for the explanation that God gives. What explanation does God give in 1 Timothy chapter 2? Verse 12 says, a woman's not to teach over, to exercise authority over a man, but to be in silence. Well, that's not fair. But David, you don't understand. That just was the culture. Keep reading. Verse 13 of 1 Timothy chapter 2 says, for Adam was formed first and then Eve. Word for says, here's the reason for it. Adam was formed first and then Eve. And the woman was the one who sinned and fell into transgression. Does that sound like it's cultural? Where does he go for an explanation in 1 Timothy 2? Does he go to the culture? No. He goes all the way back to the beginning. What's he saying? This has been the case from the get-go all the way down 4,000 years later to the time where he's writing the book of 1 Timothy. Was that a cultural thing? No. That was a God thing. It was a God thing that did not change. And so don't let somebody try to grab this from you. So, well, that's a cultural thing, so these other things are cultural. No. Look at what the entirety of the Bible says. And don't let somebody change that on you. All right, I took an extra minute and a half. Thank you all very much.